in brief, you could say there is no separation between church and state in Islam. The early Islamic community, which is the beginnings of Islam, that's the year one in the Islamic calendar is when the Islamic community was formed, was from the beginning a social, political, and religious unit guided by the Prophet. And each of those aspects of the community was important. And therefore, it always had, from its very beginnings, a political role and a political leadership and a political structure to it. And it's always been presumed then that that's necessary. The second reason is because if you look what salvation is in Islam, salvation in Islam is essentially each individual's responsibility, it is true, but it's something which the community helps and assists the individual in achieving, in the sense that conditions are created, a society, an environment is created in which Islam can be fully and successfully practiced. Because one's salvation is ultimately dependent upon doing the will of God, the whole intellectual tradition of Islam became elaborating in more and more detail just what the will of God would be in any particular situation. But this then means that all actions in life can be judged as to whether or not they are in accordance with God's will or not in accordance with God's will. There are no kinds of non-religious then actions or decisions. But that's again a view then that the whole society and everything that you do in one's life is something that is concerned with your faith. Therefore, of course, political questions, of course, enter in as well. But something that that Western society developed after the Middle Ages, the gradual separation of church and state, distinctions between these are religious actions and these are secular actions, no, that really isn't in the Islamic model to differentiate those things.
So that would explain the high degree of interest in everything political that goes on within the Islamic community.
Yes.
And also kind of the emotionalism.
Yeah, and again, it's if we're looking about the last quarter here of the 20th century and trying to understand why there is so much revived interest in reestablishing this, some of the reasons I think were given here in that Egypt provides a model that is not unique to Egypt, which is that other kinds of things have been tried in the 20th century to solve society's problems, and they haven't worked. Whether you've tried the socialistic route as Egypt did under Nasser or wide open capitalism under Sadat, all that seemed to happen was that the society seemed to increasingly get the gap between rich and poor, or other kinds of corruptions, as the activists talked about, came in. Well, if we look at our history or our traditions, say, people from this part of the world, we need to get back on the path, and the path is that of Islam, and perhaps that is the answer to our problems. Clearly, we've been running under states who haven't acknowledge that Islam needs to play an important part in guiding the way in which people are structured in their society. We need perhaps to re-inject a lot more Islam into the structures of the state. Now, the most extreme form of this has been Iran, but now Muslims in Sunni countries like Egypt are also actively campaigning. If you were to boil their political program down into one particular issue, it would be that they would insist that the Sharia, or the Islamic law, as we talked about before, become implemented as the guidelines for legislation in the state, for the way in which the whole society is ordered. Now, that still begs a few very important questions, such as who is going to interpret the Sharia, whose Islam is this going to be? Who's going to make the ultimate decisions? Iran has set up a system in which there was one clear interpreter of Islam, and the Constitution now provides in the succession that perhaps he could be succeeded by a committee. But this is a much more problematic thing in Sunni countries as well, where there have traditionally not been charismatic leaders like this who hold an unswaying appeal over all of the populace. It would be more as if you had a bunch of pastors out there. Now, which one, you know, should lead, or which one should interpret? And they don't meet in church bodies. They don't have synods or congregational meetings or national kinds of aggregations where they could even vote or pass policy resolutions or anything of that nature. And so the question becomes, you know, what vision is this going to be? The other dispute that happens with these groups too is, by what means should this be achieved? Part of Sadat's problem was that he lumped all opposition of all types together unilaterally, and when problems broke out, he preferred to clap in everybody into jail, regardless of what their particular program was. One of the things that Mubarak, his successor, has done that is more astute is that he has tried to separate out Muslim revivalists who proclaim a kind of gradualist method to achieving this goal, who are somewhat vague about how they're going to achieve it, but at least say, well, we need to reinvigorate the society, we need to get some regeneration among our people to become more active themselves in their personal lives with Islam, and then this can be reflected by increasing the role that it plays in the state. He's differentiated that group of people from the more extremist types who are featured in a film like this, who say, well, the only way to deal with it is to have an instant revolution and to use violence to overthrow anyone who is not meeting the standard of what Islam should be.
Is the violence and the revolution, is that contrary to what the laws of Islam are to begin with?
Well, again, there isn't any clear-cut rule on this one. There are certainly enough precedents, however, in Islamic history that any activist or militant can justify the use of violence to overthrow an impious kind of government. It doesn't mean that they're required to do so, though. You're certainly willing to interpret some of the actions that a person ought to take in other than violent ways, but there are plenty of precedents that exist. Did I see someone else had a hand up? Yeah.
One thing that struck me as very interesting was the demographic factors that made up this new fundamentalism. It wasn't quite what I expected it to be, and maybe if you could comment on that.
In Egypt, as he pointed out, as you noted, a lot of the new recruits are young people who are highly educated and who are frustrated, however, with their prospects individually and with the position that their country is in the world and with their recent history. In some ways, I would say they're like idealistic young people of that generation have always been in many places, and this is the current answer. This is the current hot philosophy. I mean, those of us who are older in the room can go back and remember at whenever we were in college, there always is some kind of hot book, hot guru, hot thing, which attracts the idealism of young people who are dissatisfied with the way things are. So there's some of that that's involved here. Egypt, though, has a particularly unique problem in the overpopulation that we mentioned here. A lot of people generalize, for example, on third world countries and say, well, one of their big problems is that they don't have enough educated people. You know, they need more university graduates. They need more highly trained professional people in various ways, and this is one of the things that's holding them back. A country like Egypt, one of the problems has been since the time of Nasser, who very strongly used education as a way of reinvigorating the country is that, in fact, they have far more college graduates than they can possibly place in positions that they would feel would be suitable to their talents. In fact, that began to happen relatively early in Egyptian experience, and eventually Nasser more or less guaranteed any college graduate they could get a job with the government, if no place else, which means that Egypt has one of the most unbelievable bureaucracies that you can find anywhere in the world, because there are thousands of people at desks all over the place, but many of them, and these people realize it, are in complete dead-end, white-collar, clerical jobs that will lead nowhere and will go nowhere. And the problem, as indicated here, is that Egypt starts an educational system in which, allegedly, of course, based on, as Cairo University was, based initially on Western models of education, and then presumably from their teachers getting the notion that meritocracy works, that if you have ability, you can get up the line. But Egypt, like many other societies, works along the old lines. It's who you know, other kinds of connections that determine who gets which jobs and how far you get in the system. And again, these young people, who are often the most qualified and the best, but as he also indicated, often come from rural areas or poorer socioeconomic strata and don't have those connections, they particularly feel frustrated with this. Now, for some time, Egypt has been able to farm out this problem during the 70s by providing to much of the rest of the Arab world, but particularly to the oil-rich countries in the Gulf, a whole host of highly technically trained personnel, teachers, and so forth. People who couldn't get jobs in Egypt could always go to Saudi Arabia, to Bahrain, to Kuwait, and places like that, and they could teach there, earn money, and send it back. But with the downturn in the world economy in the late 70s and other problems in the early 80s, a lot of those avenues were also cut off, and perhaps that also additionally increased the number of people who were agitating here. And another factor that was alluded to briefly in the tape, there's an attractive aspect to the puritanical aspects of Islam as a lifestyle in making a virtue of necessity. All of the young women donning the veil. He's quite right in the tape that this has been a remarkable transformation in Egypt. I was in Egypt in 73, 74. And as he said, at that time, you on the streets of Cairo, you saw almost no one wearing the veil. I was at the American University in Cairo, and I was at Cairo University as well. And again, almost no, all the students were dressing in Western dress, Western fashions, and so forth. But, of course, there's status, there's competitiveness with this kind of dressing. And now you don the veil, and if you have only one dress, well, you're making a virtue of necessity. You are saying, well, it matters not. I am by choice doing this, not because I can't have it, not because I can't do it in this way. And, you know, there's perhaps some of that with young people too. But I think some of those other factors are significantly more important with this particular group. Were there other particular questions or comments? I think if we look at let me put this up on the screen here for a moment so you can get a view of the area. If we look at some of the other countries in the region and look at the kind of challenge that they may face in regard to Islam. It might be interesting to begin down at the bottom half of the map. Before 1979 and the Iranian Revolution, if you had asked the average American, now what is the Middle Eastern country that is most Islamic. I think most people would have answered Saudi Arabia. It was widely seen and perceived to be a very conservative Islamic country. This was the place where they, you know, executed criminals by cutting off their heads and sometimes lopped off the hands of thieves, supposedly, or whatever. But it was alleged to be that. By the way, I should make a parenthetical comment about the tape. It's interesting that they were quizzing this young student about Islamic laws and punishments, when, of course, it would be the equivalent, perhaps, of interviewing the average American sophomore about technical issues in our legal system instead of a lawyer. I mean, they could have just as well interviewed a member of the ulama, someone who had studied Islamic law. He's off the boat, in fact, on a couple of the interpretations that he's making there. But it does give you a bit of a distorted view about what those things are. But in any case, Saudi Arabia certainly was perceived to be a highly conservative place. And so if we look then at the threat of Islamic fundamentalism in a place like Saudi Arabia, theoretically, should they be in good shape or not? They're already supposedly a very conservative place in terms of Islam. Well, have they had any problems? Anybody remember anything in recent years that would have some bearing on Islamic fundamentalism? Yes.
Didn't they have a riot in
Yes, in fact, more than that, in the same year of the Iranian Revolution, November of that year, there was a group of, these were Sunni fundamentalists, who took over the great mosque in Mecca and held it as with an armed force, and asked or demanded that their leader be declared the Mahdi, or the expected one, the chosen reinvigorator of Islam. And they made other demands that indicated that they were very dissatisfied with the kind of corruption that had taken place in the Saudi dynasty, etc., etc. In other words, Saudi Arabia was not Islamic enough for them. And they had, in fact, taken over the holiest place of Islam. It would be for the equivalent of the Catholic Church to be occupying the Vatican with a group of fundamentalists who proclaimed that the church had gone astray and corrupt and whatever. The Saudis have been walking a very delicate line, because the origins of Saudi Arabia as a country have been based to a large degree on their legitimacy as Islamic monarchs. They linked up, the Saudi dynasty, linked up with a revivalist movement of that began in the late 18th century, but was revived in the early 20th century, called the Wahhabi movement, which was very puritanical, very much back to the basics of Islam in terms of the Quran and the Sunnah, and throwing out all of the later accretions. And that was the basis by which they had seized power and united all the tribes of Arabia, is that they were bringing this kind of revival to the Islam of Arabia. So their legitimacy is supposed to rest on them being good Muslims. This makes it, on the one hand, it gives them that kind of retrospective legitimacy to the dynasty, but it also makes them susceptible to any kind of opposition that claims that they, in fact, are not doing what they've said they've always done. And this has been a particularly difficult tightrope for the Saudis to walk ever since the oil wealth, especially beginning in the mid-70s, has started to flow in such amounts that it has led to inevitable kinds of changes that have been so drastic in the materialistic lifestyle of Saudis that it could threaten the kind of social customs that are associated with conservative Islam as well. One of the king who was most responsible for trying to modernize Saudi Arabia and at the same time retain its Islamic traditions was King Faisal, who you may remember was king from through the 60s and early 70s. Anybody remember what happened to King Faisal? He was assassinated. He was assassinated by another member of the royal family who was immediately declared to be mentally unstable and was quickly executed. But some people believe that he had links, again, with more extreme Muslim factions who were unhappy with the recent decision that Faisal had just made to install television in Saudi Arabia, which, if you want to go really extreme in terms of a fundamentalist view, could be that this not only could bring in the corrupting images of the West, though Saudi television does censor the kinds of programs it brings in, but even in creating and transmitting images over the airwaves could be something that could be a little bit risque. In other words, the Saudis, as conservative as they've been, have had opposition out on the right, if you will, who are watching them, who are oftentimes upset with the pace and the styles of modernization that have been going on. As a result, the Saudis have been extremely careful in trying to control the way in which that kind of modernization takes place. To give you but one example, since in particular with many conservative Muslims, as you saw from some of the activists on the tape, the corrupting influence of Western-style male-female relationships is particularly to be avoided. The Saudis have been particularly assiduous in following those kinds of taboos, and the result has often been they've had the wealth to be able to preserve these even at much greater cost. To give you but one example, they have been encouraging the education of women, but it has to be done in a segregated fashion. Women, when after they reach the age of puberty, should not at all be seen or taught by males. This resulted in sometimes building duplicate sets of facilities, as you have to do. You have to build not just one biology lab, but two biology labs, etc., all the way through. One of the reasons for encouraging women is that you would prefer to have a large number of women doctors so that all women could be treated by doctors, by female doctors, and not be touched by male doctors, and so on. And you would want women professionals in the women's side of the establishment to be teachers and so forth. There are now women's banks in Saudi Arabia in which women go in and can make their deposits, and all the tellers and all the personnel in there are women, and it's only for women. But this kind of dichotomy is, of course, as I say, very expensive. It's replicating a lot of facilities and things that don't need to be used, but the Saudis have used their oil wealth in order to try to do that. That's how they've been trying to toe the line, but it's not something that even they are immune from, it should be noted. Many of the other countries in the Middle East, let's list a few. If we went across North Africa, which isn't on the map here, we'd have Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco going in that direction. And if we add those countries to those that you see on the map, a significant number of these countries are still led by governments which are basically secularist in their outlook. And these governments are certainly looking over their shoulders at the rise of Islam. They are men who sometimes came to power as a result of nationalist revolutions and obtained their legitimacy that way. That would be the leadership in Algeria, which threw out the French and got a lot of popular support as a result of that, but created a basically secular socialist-style government in its image once it had achieved its independence. Other nationalists like Nasser also followed a kind of attempted socialism, in part because when these people, and Nasser was reacting against British colonialism, these people, when they saw the evils that their society had followed, felt that the exploitation of capitalist colonialist regimes was responsible for it. So that's one of the reasons they did it. We're out of time, but what the final comment that I would make about these regimes is that they're all, to one degree or another, experiencing Islamic revivals because they haven't been able to deliver what they have experienced, what they have promised. And one might look for some kinds of problems to come up. However, many of them are also ruthlessly repressive regimes. They are led by military commanders who took power in very bloody coups and who know very well how to monitor their opposition. And in particular, the leaders of both Iraq and Syria fit into this category quite well, and they have ruthlessly repressed Islamic opposition, which has been quite strong at various times there. And so right now, on the immediate horizon, I don't see any Islamic revivalism starting there, primarily because those people are marched off to jail and executed and tortured as soon as they become known. But it's obviously something under the surface that these people, in the long run, are going to have to deal with. Well, we have to stop, but if some those of you who want to hit the first setting can go ahead here. If some of you would like to continue to talk a moment or two, I'd be willing to stay.